Welcome to Fanboy News Network, your guide to geek culture. I'm Jeff Harris.
And I'm Daniel Christensen.
So, those of you keeping track, yes, it's actually been 3 weeks since we last put out an episode. Daniel and I did get together last week for our regular pre-recording dinner. We looked at each other and went, we are both exhausted.
Well, because I was also double duty as Typhoid Mary last week. I managed to get two different people sick, and I was like, no, I'm done now. I want to go home and lay down.
And I just had a super long week at work, and I was just, it hit the point I was like, okay, we're just going to stare at each other a lot and not 100% sure what we were going to talk about. We just decided the universe was telling us, give it a week.
Yeah.
So anyway, we're back now. It also allowed a few interesting things to happen.
Interesting in the oh God, we're all going to die sense?
Well, you know, I don't like to talk about politics on this show.
Oh, yeah, well.
No. So, Halloween.
Oh, yes.
Occurred.
Oh, that.
Yeah, and, you know, some interesting stuff happened. Nothing big on any national front I can think of. It was Halloween.
The scary thing, the scary clowns thing.
Okay, so speaking of scary clowns.
Okay.
All right, so yes, there's a fad, because that's what it is. There's a fad of people going around dressed as scary clowns acting creepy.
Yes.
You know what? I was also early 20-something making bad decisions in my life. I just went about it in different ways.
Yes, and you know, there wasn't the internet when we were young and stupid.
So. No, that's true. But speaking of clowns, not necessarily of the scary variety, although...
I was going to say, he qualifies.
Although, to be fair, there are some people, my sister included, who think all clowns are scary.
Yes, coulrophobia is the word.
Yes, and there are many horror films that depict frightening clowns. It's a very common trope. In fact, in Family Skeletons, there is a character who does not appear on stage in season one, but there is an entire faction of scary clowns. It is a thing. Jill was not happy. She's like, as co-creator, can I veto the clowns? And my answer was no.
No, as a matter of fact.
No, there's going to be scary clowns. Go ahead.
I was going to say, weren't you just recently saying that the likelihood of Tim Curry killing you is directly proportionate to how much makeup he's wearing?
How much makeup he's wearing, yeah.
You know, as the butler, you got a 1 in 7 chance. As Frankenfurter,
about
50-50. He's dressed up as Pennywise, you're dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One performer that I've been enamored with for a few years now is Puddle's Pity Party.
Oh, yes.
Now, those of you in internet land probably know him from his collaborations with Postmodern Jukebox, where he performs largely covering Lord songs or other songs. Usually he often covers songs by female performers, but his shtick is taking pop songs and doing them in a more cabaret style. That, and he's a 6'8" man who dresses as a sad Pagliacci clown.
There's that. No, because the two that I've mainly seen him as, he does the cover of Lord's Royals, but he also does Cohen's Hallelujah.
He does Cohen's Hallelujah, which is one of the best renditions of Hallelujah. He also, with Postmodern Jukebox, did a cover of Lord's Team, did a cover of Sia's Chandelier. Collaborating with an artist whose name I can't remember right now, he does a cover of Tears for Fears' Mad World.
Interesting.
Plus, he's well known for doing other covers. If you go on the internet and look up on YouTube, he's got a lot of different songs he's done. And interesting, so the reason I'm bringing this up is...
Dum, dum, dum.
On Halloween, he performed in Seattle at Teatro Zinzani, which is a combination dinner theater circus.
Yes.
And he did it. It's a show he's been touring with. So I got to see him live. And there's a sign very clearly placed as you come in saying that you are given full permission to take video and pictures during the show. So a lot of video gets posted of him because people take video and put them up of his various songs.
Go figure.
He's an amazing performer. Trying to describe his voice, it's a very powerful voice. He's got excellent diction, projection, and breath control. He sounds almost like he was possibly trained as an opera singer.
I wouldn't doubt it.
But he tends to do cabaret style, but he'll do a lot of interesting covers. And he's an amazing performer because he never talks. He either sings or is doing the silent clown shtick. And he's, it's not just, oh, a singer's dressed as a clown. He's got an entire act.
Yeah.
It was amazing. It was one of the best things my wife and I have seen all year. And it was in a theater in the round setting. So he was very interactive with the crowd. It was great. Yeah. And if you've not seen his stuff online, I highly recommend it. He does interesting things, like he does a cover of The Who's Pinball Wizard, but sung to the tune of Folsom Prison Blues.
All right.
And done in a Johnny Cash style. He does some interesting covers of Queen's Under Pressure. Well, Queen and David Bowie's Under Pressure. Of ELO's Telephone Line. And just many, many other songs. But it was a great night. And he is an amazing performer. And everyone... there's pictures. I had my picture taken with him.
Of course you did.
Because of course I did. So, no, that was fun. And I know that I would never get Jill to see him live.
Of course not.
I think the next time he comes to town, I am going to try and get a group together. So, that was fun. And very appropriate for Halloween night.
Yeah. I do think it's interesting that there's kind of a return to that thing where performers will meet up with their audience afterwards. Because not only is the last show you saw, Puddle's Pity Party, where he does that, my wife and I have got tickets to go see Henry Rollins in January, which is going to be awesome. And he famously stays till everyone's done. And also Penn and Teller, that we got to see in Vegas a while mm-hmm. back. They put on, you know, always put on an amazing show. Mm-hmm. And they always stay until every last person is out of the theater.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and I think it helps build rapport with the audience.
Oh, that's, yeah.
You know.
Well, and in Penn and Teller's case, they specifically say that they've always done it
mm-hmm.
from back when they were just barely beginning. So it's crowd and fan interaction, but it's also just the appreciation of thanks for coming.
Yeah. So yeah, that was fun. And now when I had I was gonna. We never did talk much about your recent performance.
What, Rite of Jupiter?
Yeah.
Oh, it was amazing. It was outstanding. The DVD comes out in February. Get a copy now. Buddy of mine writes rock operas for fun. And so far he's written 6 of the things. And for whatever reason, he has decided that his medium is going to be rock operas, putting to music the phenomenally opaque poetry of Aleister Crowley, the early 20th century occultist. Yeah, it was fun. It's great. I sing and dance and wear leather pants. I, you know, have on a little extra guy liner. I had my hair up in a pompadour. It was my longest my hair has been in 20 years. It was amazing. These things are great. And I enjoyed the little tidbit that he has written 6 rock operas. So we're looking at what? Probably 18 hours worth of music
mm-hmm.
in 15 years.
Yeah.
It took Wagner 24 years to write 4 operas. So he's ahead of Wagner at this point. I think that right there is.
Well, but he didn't have to write the book.
True.
You know, he gets to take Alistair's, because these are already existing plays, the Rites of Eleusis.
Right. For those of you at home, we're both using air quotes on this. He wrote plays with no stage direction and little clue as to what that was going on. And frankly, he cribbed a lot of it himself. There's classic poetry in that,
yeah.
in the stuff as well. So.
So, as Jennifer Lovely mentioned when she was guest co-hosting, I myself was in the leather pants once.
Yes.
did, in fact, perform in as a last-minute replacement performer.
Well, you were a last-minute replacement for a last-minute replacement. It was impressive.
So.
Yes, you were in leather pants, but let us not forget the orange billowy shirt, too.
That, yeah, yeah.
The orange silky billowy shirt. It was amazing.
Which I did not keep.
Oh, really?
I do not have that orange billowy shirt. I do not know. I do not know where that orange billowy shirt is, and maybe that's for the best.
I don't know. Let's see.
anyway, so with our theatrical endeavors or experiences aside, in the world of geek culture, we fortunately, since the last time we went over it, don't have any conventions behaving badly stories.
That is some of the best news I've heard in a while.
But we do have a continuation of our examination of the growth patterns of conventions.
Oh my, yes.
So, as regular listeners will know, or anyone who's read my articles on the site, one of the things, because part of my professional life involves doing analytics, I decided to do a look at patterns of growth of conventions using Burning Man as a benchmark and San Diego Comic-Con as sort of the main example, and was charting growth patterns of comic conventions primarily, but any geek culture convention that tends to show growth.
Right.
And with the postulation that part of the pattern is ancillary shows growing as other shows become too hard to get to.
Right.
Well, part of that projection, we were looking at the local convention, Emerald City Comic Con, as, you know, would it follow this pattern we predicted? And as of this year, it certainly is still following our predicted pattern, which is that every year ticket sales increase. However, once you hit maximum occupancy at a site, as Emerald City has, that increase stops taking the form of more tickets sold and starts taking the form of the show selling out sooner and sooner.
Oh my, yes.
And this year, Emerald City, now you got a 4-day pass.
No, I did not.
Oh, you did not.
I only did the a la carte. I got 2-day passes for Friday and Saturday.
Okay.
But 4-day passes, I've gotten two reports. It is between 10 to 20 minutes of them going on sale that the 4-day pass is sold out. And as of, I think, last week or possibly the week before, so...
Middle of last week.
So from October 19th to...
24th.
So in a week, Saturday is completely sold out.
Yeah.
So at this point, there are Thursdays, Fridays, and Sundays left. And interestingly, Thursday, Friday, Sunday will run you the same amount as a 4-day pass.
Right. So basically, it's selling out faster.
Oh my, yes.
Because last year, I remember the whole weekend passes sold out the first day.
Yeah.
But you still had most of the day where you're able to get them. And it took a couple of weeks before the first single days sold out. So, yeah, it's still following that growth pattern. I decided I was going to skip this year. I just didn't feel like putting forth the effort of going. With my current job right now, I have to make choices of events I want to do when I want to take time off. And I'm still planning on taking time off for NorwestCon. And I'm planning right now to travel to join Jill for Bats Day at Disneyland in May. So those are where I'm going to budget my vacation time.
As well you should.
And when Saturday passes went so fast, I finally went, you know what? Just never mind.
A couple things that that stand out for me. The other big thing to point out is in previous years, Emerald City Comic Con has had VIP passes.
True.
Which, for those of you not in the area... VIP passes basically get you head of the line to any celebrity autograph. And I don't know if it's guaranteed seating, but there are reserved seats in the front of every panel room. So no matter what, you can always get in. You can get your celebrity time. You can get the head of the line for pictures and so on. They did away with those this year. They said that it had to do with wanting a more equality in the fan experience. Part of me is okay with this. Cause I mean, I think that in the past they have been, I mean, it's a moneymaker for sure. because, you know, a 4-day pass is what, $100, $110, and a VIP pass was 2 to 3 times that.
Something like that. It was really, yeah, it felt weird.
Yeah. And I mean, I remember actually the year that I got to meet Sir Patrick Stewart. I was the first muggle in line because I was a minion that year. Mm-hmm. And I got there early, got in line. There was another guy that had the VIP pass, walked up in front of me. It was $100 an autograph. He plunked down 5 Benjamins and got 5 autographs and walked back out the door because that was what he was there for.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to make that money back on what he got those autographs.
Sure.
But be that as it may, I thought that was really interesting that they've done away with the VIP passes. So it'll be interesting to see the outcome.
Yeah.
But I'm inspired by it. The other tidbit that I keep saying this out loud because eventually I'm going to have to believe it.
All right.
So I bought 3 sets of passes.
All right.
One for myself, one for my wife, and one from my mother, who has decided that she's heard a lot about the Comic-Con that's in her hometown. And she wants to come up and go to Emerald City Comic-Con, and specifically, well, as backstory, last year my wife and I went as Sadness and Anger from Inside Out.
Right.
My mother has decided that not only does she want to go to Emerald City Comic-Con, she wants to cosplay Joy.
Okay.
My mother, the 71-year-old cosplayer, I think it's awesome. How can I say no?
Sure.
I mean, I think that is so awesome that she's going to play something that this is what is part of the experience in her world.
I don't know enough about the Comic-Con scene in Utah to know if Emerald City compares to anything in her area.
Salt Lake City Comic-Con is actually a huge con.
Okay, so...
Because you got to have something to obsess about when you live in Salt Lake City, and... Yeah, it's nerds, and they've had some really high attendance because the place that they hold it, the Salt Palace, is huge.
Okay,
and they've gotten a lot of big names. I think they've had Mark Hamill. They've had, you know, some large name fans that have attended, but she doesn't want to do that. She wants to come up to Seattle, in part so she can play dress up with her son. Sure.
We are the geek capital of the world. So.
Exactly.
Yeah. The only other thing I was thinking about from my last point on Emerald City is the one thing I know is a lot of vendors are waiting to hear if they're getting table space.
Yeah.
And this includes a lot of longtime vendors.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the comic shops that regularly... Local comic shops that regularly have a presence, not all of them have heard if they're getting space yet this year.
Which I think speaks a lot to what you were talking about over dinner, is the idea of what's going to happen now that Reed Propp's in charge.
Yeah, and it is a concern because a lot of people are pointing to, yeah, this is Reed Propp making these decisions. We know they shrunk Artists Alley, not the scope of the alley, but... They're looking for more big name artists, and some of the local artists that always had space aren't getting space anymore.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know. I have friends. I have been a vendor
mm-hmm.
before. My wife used to work at the shows and sell geeky soap. But I've known a lot of vendors at the show, and a lot of them, and everyone agrees it's their biggest show of the year. It's where they make the most money at any given weekend. And a lot of the mainstays are like, we haven't heard if we're getting space.
That's amazing. Because, I mean, Seattle, you know, like you say, kind of the geek capital. And to have mainstays like that not being able to get space. I mean, do we really need an even larger Dark Horse presence? Do we need an even larger, you know, some of these things? Because until they start, unless there's going to start becoming like releases, like the sneak releases, like what they do with San Diego. What's the point of having a larger?
I don't know.
I don't know.
So anyway, Did you have one more point?
Oh, the only other thing I was going to say, as far as the as far as geek culture in Salt Lake City, many of you have seen the video floating around. It's the Talk Nerdy to Me video. It's a Filk song based off of the Talk Dirty to Me,
mm-hmm.
which, come to find out, I was still thinking Poison from back in the 80s. No, this is a new R&B song. That video was done by the nerds in Salt Lake. It's an incredible video. If you get a chance, Talk Nerdy to Me. It's the one with two guys dressed up in original series Star Trek uniforms. It's hilarious. It's very well done.
Yeah.
It's, yeah.
So, moving on.
Dug-a-dump.
The in movies, have you made anything in the theater recently?
Not a single thing. My wife and I have decided that we are not going to go see Doctor Strange, basically because we just don't want to give the money to the whitewashing that's been happening with that. We are looking forward to Moana, which, if you think about it, it's funny because the money ends up in the same pocket.
Yeah.
It all belongs
to Disney.
It all goes back to Disney. But it's, I mean, Marvel is not hurting for cash. Neither is Disney.
Yeah.
But I have X amount of money. I do not have an infinite amount of money. So it's going to go towards seeing Dwayne The Rock Johnson as Maui, the demigod. I think it's going to be awesome.
And I have to say, with Moana, I love the fact that, you know, with an era where there's so many accusations of whitewashing, and in an animated film where you could get away with it more,
mm-hmm.
that Disney made the decision to have their two leads in a movie about Polynesian culture be played by two Polynesians.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. I think it's awesome. And it's, yeah, that is something that I'm really excited about. And
Alan Tudyk's in it, but he's playing a chicken.
Yes, Alan Tudyk. His two film credits this year are a chicken and
a droid.
How does one describe the droid character that he's going to be in Star Wars? He's like the anti C-3PO. I know that.
But let's just go with that. Anti C-3PO.
If you turn C-3PO inside out and mated him with Marvin the Paranoid Android from Hitchhiker's Guide, I think that's closer to it.
Well, Alan's sort of become, as a voice actor, a good luck charm for Disney. I mean, he's been in Frozen, he's been in Wreck-It Ralph, they're going to have him in Moana, and they went, oh, well, we might as well throw him in Star Wars. So yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to Moana. It looks fantastic.
Yeah.
I am going to go see Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
The comic fanboy in me can't stop myself. And, you know, this is the guy who kind of ended up shrugging his shoulders at Suicide Squad. But I am definitely going to see Doctor Strange. But the other movie I am seeing this weekend,
mm-hmm.
before I get into stuff I've actually seen, there is a special release of Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh, yes.
The black and chrome edition.
It's, yes.
There's a kind of been a movement recently to take movies that were released in color and do black and white prints of them. It really is an interesting, and I'm hearing that people are saying, yeah, this looks great. Because in black and white, when you take the color out, you have to actually pay more attention to the action.
The thing that I'm the most curious about as far as the Fury Road is because one of the things that struck me about the original was that the color was so saturated. It was turned to 11 saturation mm-hmm. of the color. So the desert was such a bright, stark orange, and the skies were such a bright blue that taking all that away, I wonder what it's going to... I mean, obviously, like you say, it'll pay more attention to the action, which brings it back to the amazing editing that she did for the show.
And that's the only change. This is not like a special director's cut. This is just, it is a black and white print of Fury Road. But, so there is a movie from a few years ago, The Mist, based on a Stephen King story.
Right.
And a very effective story, but a lot of people dismiss the movie because... They dismiss The Mist because of the heavy reliance on CGI. Because the plot is a mysterious mist rolls in and strange creatures come out of it. And a lot of those creatures were realized through CGI. And, you know, with certain budget CGI can look wonky. Well, you turn that movie and make it black and white, which on the Blu-ray release, they did a black and white version. You watch that movie without the color, suddenly the CGI is no longer a distraction. Turning something to black and white covers a lot of cinematic sins.
So people used to be pissed and now it should not be missed?
I'm not even giving you credit for that one. You should just, you know, we're going to pause the recording while Daniel just sits there and thinks about what he's done.
And high fives himself.
That's, yeah. I would say you sit there and you feel bad, but I know you. You're only going to do one of those things.
Yep, I'm just going to sit here.
So, anyway. Yeah, so I'm looking forward to that. The recent movie I did see, and it kind of, interestingly, thematic, following along, there was a movie, it came out this year, called Lights Out.
Okay.
Had a very brief theatrical run, and has very quickly went to video, and that is a crime.
Just to be sure, this is like horror suspense sort of thing?
Yeah.
Does it have any connection to the old Lights Out radio show?
No.
Okay.
No, it doesn't. Which, it's interesting, because I listened to that growing up.
Yeah.
But... No, it is, what's interesting is it was a two-minute horror short that was one of the horror shorts that kind of went viral on YouTube.
Okay.
And the original short was a woman at home getting ready for bed. She turns out the lights, and when the moment she turns out the light, there's a figure in her hallway. Turns the light on, it's gone, and there's this whole off and on thing. So it's based on that. And the movie... is made by the guy who made the original short.
Oh, nice.
They let him take his and expand it to an entire story. The thing is, this is, and if you listen to the most recent episode of Don't Read the Latin, they also talk about it because we all watched it together. This movie had one of the best scripts I've seen in a long time for a horror film, in that it respects the intelligence of its characters. It doesn't have the characters do stupid things just to perpetuate the plot.
Nice change.
And it respects their arcs and lets them go to logical conclusions. And it actually pokes fun at a lot of horror tropes.
Nice.
It has a character. All I will say is this. It has a character... that the only thing they could have added to say this character is doomed is have him be 3 days from retirement. And they've completely flipped the expectations of the character's fate on its head. So, and in fact, they had this character do all these things that's like, oh, okay, he's doing this stupid horror thing. No, he's actually got a good reason for what he's doing. And had this constant of just respecting the character's intellect, and respecting when characters make a sacrifice, it's not pointless.
Nice.
So, on that level, it was refreshing. And, I would recommend it.
And this is Lights Out.
Lights Out.
Okay.
And, there's... one thing, if you're interested in where good horror is these days... You know, we've talked a lot about it's the indie horror scene is where you want to look. The best mainstream, James Tan... is, and he's a producer on Lights Out, by the way. But he, you know, the guy who does the Conjuring films, he's probably the best mainstream, but indie. But a lot of people are trying to prove their chops by doing shorts for YouTube and really effective horror shorts. So the original Lights Out short on YouTube, very effective, well worth. Same director made one called Panic in the Attic. That is worth checking out. There is another one that I think is even shorter called Bedfellow that is worth... So there's a lot of good horror just coming out of the online shorts community that people are noticing, hey, these guys kind of know what they're doing. Let's see what they do with an expanded budget and storytelling mechanism.
Which I have to laugh because you think about it, there was that... one of Adam Sandler's worst flops... which is saying something, was Pixels, which was based on an original, like, 2-3 minute short that some French guy had done. And he took it, expanded it, And things got Peter Dinklage in it, and I still won't watch it.
Well, I think what comes down to is it's, you know, it's one thing to expand on a good idea, mm-hmm. but there better be a good script. I think what Lights Out proves is if you've got a good script backing it up.
Yeah.
And this is why, again, we're into the era of, yeah, the directors are great, and I do like good directors, but it's more and more, it's a writer's medium. And what I even though I love the James Tan, mm-hmm. he, and I love his movies, he's a great horror director. As I discussed with Jennifer Lovely, yeah, he's a producer on Lights Out, but you know, he recognized somebody threw money at him. He didn't make the movie. It's the directors and the writers you got to care about these days.
You know, I have to say that's one of the pet peeves of mine as well.
And there goes my cat.
Hi, Pussycat. Because several years ago, probably 10 years ago now, there was an incredible Jet Li movie called Hero.
Yes.
One of my all-time favorite movies, mm-hmm. hands down. And I saw it when it originally came out, because at the time I was dating a woman who was, suffice to say, she was very interested in the movie. We went and saw it. Mm-hmm. It was amazing. When it finally came out on DVD, I run out and grab the DVD, and it's like, Quentin Tarantino presents. And I'm like, Quentin Tarantino did nothing in this movie. He basically said, let's bring it, let's release it on DVD.
Yeah, he secured the American distribution.
And oh, but yo, yeah. Suffice to say, Hero, basically the history of China, and instead of an opera, it's like, I think Genevieve was saying that
it's a ballet.
Well, it's like an opera, only instead of arias, they have sword fights.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It is, and very cultural.
Very cultural, beautiful. Actually,
and one of the things I love is, and this is because Jet Li loves working with the guy. Donnie Yen was one of the co-stars, and one of the best fights in that movie is Jet Li and Donnie Yen, because yeah. they're both amazing. Donnie Yen is playing the blind Force Master in Rogue One. Just so you know,
yeah, yeah.
There's a reason we're excited about that.
My wife and I watched the first Ip Man movie for the first time last weekend. And she was just all sorts of like, who is this guy? What is he doing? I'm like, oh, we'll be seeing him some more of him in December, honey.
His filmography is well worth tracking down.
Oh, yeah.
Well worth tracking down. So, yeah. So that's on that front. Now, the other thing that happened today, a lot of trailers dropped this week.
Yeah.
Well, not a lot, but some significant trailers.
Some significant
trailers dropped this week. The big one is a more expanded, like, 2-minute Wonder Woman trailer that I think we can sum up with, well, the best distillation I heard of it is somebody going, oh, please, let the movie be as good as this trailer looks.
Which, yes.
So, it looks great. It has color, saturation.
Yeah,
it's, even though it's set in World War I, look, Wonder Woman is in, you can tell tone in her costume.
Yes.
It's amazing. But no, it's also, I there's a lot of choices I love they've made, the trailer shows that maybe weren't even as evident in Batman versus Superman. Not the least of which is somebody went, so Wonder Woman's Greek. So she probably doesn't speak with an American accent. And they have her not speaking with an American accent.
Good.
So I know there's a lot of people that keep talking about, oh, Gal Gadot's too small and skinny to play Wonder Woman. My first thing is, Gal Gadot was in the Israeli army and can probably kill you.
There's that. I was going to say, I saw some of the behind the scenes stuff from with her shooting with Jason Momoa. And
yeah,
if she can hold her own against Jason Momoa, dear God.
Yeah. I'm just saying I don't have a problem with the casting of her. I think she brings the right presence to the character.
Yes.
The trailer looks fantastic.
Good.
And that's my favorite bit in the trailer. There's always a little comedic stinger at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Wonder Woman getting set during World War I. So somebody's getting her a proper dress. And she's trying on the dress, and her first question is, I don't understand. How could you possibly fight in this thing? So, yeah, it's going to be great. And Danny Houston's in it, and I'm always a fan of Danny Houston. I think he's playing the big villain, or one of the big villains.
I just thought of something, because I just find it interesting, because so they're doing the step back, you know, because we've been done to death with World War II stuff,
right?
Especially with Captain America and all that. I find it interesting that not only are we taking this step back to World War I for Wonder Woman, but they're also do the new Battlefield. The new Battlefield game is Battlefield 1, and it is set World War I.
I think you're right. World War II has been done to death, and there should be more attention to what was World War I, and why was it significant, and why did it lead to the events of World War II. The other thing I know the director has stated, that the reasons for setting Wonder Woman, or I don't know if it's the director or the screenwriter, but the reasons are, A, World War I was a less black and white war. The Germans were less clear-cut villains at that time. There was more going on than just Nazis. So, A, little bit more ambiguity, but also by setting it in World War I, you have Wonder Woman involved with suffragettes.
Yes, that's an excellent point. And frankly, the rest of the story is that we are looking at the centenary.
Yeah.
The centennial, pardon me.
Right. Well, it also opens up a lot of possibility, like, you know, let's assume that this is going to be a hit. For sequels, they have the option of, all right, now what does she do during World War II?
Yeah.
So it's all around, it's a decision I applaud.
Oh, yeah.
The other trailer that came out today wasn't a theatrical trailer. It was for a new Netflix series, which at this point I think we can all declare that Netflix clearly knows what they're doing.
Oh, yes.
It's an interesting thing. We live in an era, before I get into the trailer, I was looking at stuff today, and it amazes me where, you know, yes, we've got traditional television, and it's still holding on, but more and more when you're looking for what is moving the cultural conversation, we are looking at non-traditional media. And by non-traditional, I mean Netflix, which it's big, but it's still a non-traditional from the normal way television series are following. And now you've got Amazon Video, which made the simple decision of, we got no problem doing exactly what Netflix is doing. It clearly works.
Yeah, I was going to say, if it's not broke, don't fix it.
And they're putting out, I mean, they've got Man in the High Castle. They've got the Tick series coming out. They're doing their own original content. So you've got these streaming services that are, A, doing their own original content, packaging it in the way it is the movement of, let's present the viewing audience with the material, and then they can consume it however they choose.
Binge appropriate. Or binge possible.
Yeah. And the fact is that when, you know, what are the big things people have been talking about lately? I'll tell you, the Halloween costumes, the number of people that posted costumes based on Stranger Things.
Stranger Things is huge.
And, you know, Luke Cage has been huge. So the whole Marvel. And Netflix, other Netflix series, and they may not get as much attention as these shows, but they still find audiences. And the trailer that dropped today is Netflix is doing a series based on Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate Events.
Nice.
Which, yeah, there was the movie with Jim Carrey, but there was issues with that. But again, it's the, you know, you look at, again, at Stranger Things or Luke Cage, where you get a lot more story because the storytellers get to tell their story in a length appropriate. Stranger Things did 8 or 9 episodes. They didn't do the full 13. They told enough to tell their story and then moved on. But you get more nuance. You can get deeper into the story by doing it in the series format. But if you create it in the bingeable, you watch as you want.
Yeah.
And I think, again, a series like Lemony Snicket, giving a chance to do a series where they can tell the story at a pacing that's more appropriate. That and Count Olaf is now played by Neil Patrick Harris.
I love it. Ah, yes.
And I was like, boy, you know, looking at the actors they could have chosen for that, it's like, I have absolutely no problem with that casting choice.
NPH is Olaf. I love it.
And apparently Lemony Snicket, because as a narrator, Lemony's right. Apparently that's Patrick Warburton.
What a combination. All right.
So, you know, again, Netflix at this point has hit the prestige level where they can get the stars because mm-hmm. people are looking like, oh, yes, the Netflix series. Why sign me up, please? Yes. Winona Ryder is actually having a little bit of a career renaissance thanks to Stranger Things.
Again.
And Sigourney Weaver is going to be the villain of the Defenders series.
I'm going to springboard here for a second because we talked a little bit about Luke Cage and Stranger Things.
Right.
And Sigourney Weaver makes me think of the most recent movie that she was in.
Mm-hmm.
And we've also just passed Halloween.
Right.
Let's count the number of Luke Cage
mm-hmm.
costumes that we saw. Let's count the number of Stranger Things costumes that we saw. Let's count the number of female Ghostbusters.
Oh, it was huge. I know a lot of people are like, oh, the movie didn't do that great. Well,
my little left elbow, it didn't do that.
Well, I don't know what they're looking at for their... Well, I think it was they spent a lot of money on the promotion.
Yes.
But if you look at it from what are we having for a cultural narrative? Because you're right, there is... When I saw Puddle's Pity Party, it was Halloween night, so many people were in costume.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an entire group of female Ghostbusters.
Yes.
One of my friend's kids...
Yeah.
Went as Holtzman for Halloween. It was, and you look all over the Halloween post from the internet, and there's whole posts of little girls as Ghostbusters because they suddenly got to see a representation for them
yes.
on screen.
Yes. And that is such an important thing. Not just the Ghostbusters, but what's her name? Eleven. Elle from Stranger Things. And... Frank, you know, Luke Cage and his entire cast.
Yeah.
It's lovely. It's wonderful to see all these wonderful alternatives that are popping up.
Yeah, representation matters.
Indeed.
And we're getting it. And that's why, again, a lot of people are like, why are the Star Wars movies being led by females? Well, maybe because females want to have heroes too.
Yeah.
You know, we've been crying for a Black Widow movie for how long?
And we will forever.
And well, we might eventually get it. There are signs that Marvel may be beginning to cave because of demand.
I was going to say, yeah, I saw that thing from Kevin Feige the other day about wanting to increase the diversity. I'm like, dude, increasing the diversity in Marvel is it's not that large of a step, really.
Yeah. First off, stop whitewashing.
Yeah, there's that. Yeah. But yeah, it. I very much would love to see something like that, but it goes back to the frustration over what's his name, Perlmutter. And well, so long as he still has a say in it,
it's going to be issues. Yeah. So yeah, I think you're right. And I think again, those narratives are very important.
Yeah.
And we're seeing it. If this year gave us nothing, it gave us that. And let's face it. The reason a lot of people are excited about Wonder Woman. Yeah. We're getting a Wonder Woman movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I promise you, I know what next year's Halloween costumes for little girls are going to be.
Yeah, well, because this year it was remarkably entertaining between going to Rose City Comic Con in Portland
mm-hmm.
and Halloween this year. There were a ton of Harley Quinns.
Uh-huh.
I was amused because you could tell it ran the gamut in ages,
mm-hmm.
but you could see where they started running into. Basically, parents saying you're not leaving the house dressed like that. So you end up with, you know, it's not just the booty shorts, it's down to the knees or the t-shirt that's untucked all the way down.
Well, and the sad thing is, Harley's original costume was unitard. Head to toe.
Yeah.
So, in fact, I got in a loot crate, I got a Harley Quinn figure
mm-hmm.
that's an original design from Batman the Animated Series Harley Quinn.
Nice.
Complete with the hyenas. Love it. So, yeah. Other than that, I mean, since we've obviously segued into TV
yep.
with the Netflix stuff, you know, the rest of the TV shows I'm watching, you know, that I don't have anything to add that I haven't said week after week. Arrow remains a bit of a disappointment. The Flash is really great. Even though the new name of the show, although this week wasn't quite as bad on that front, the new name of the show is now officially Damn It, Barry. Legends of Tomorrow, used to be the weakest show of the CWDCs. It's now really coming into its own.
Cool.
I think because they're not hamstrung by the Vandal Savage story. And Supergirl's fantastic. That's all we really have to say about that. So, other than that, with TV and Ghost Rider on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. So, the comic shows going great. I'd say if you're interested in what's else geek. Dark Matter on Sci-Fi is probably the best thing they got going, although I hear The Expanse is just as good.
I was going to say, over the summer, I read the first Expanse book, mm-hmm. and if the TV show is anything like that, I count me in.
So, yeah, and I think we mentioned before, because Dark Matter is that the show that takes that episode of Star Trek The Next Generation and expands it to an entire series. It's good. I'm trying to think what else is big on the genre stuff right now. Well, you know what? The one thing I will say is this for another genre show. I am one of the few people that did not get into The Walking Dead. I watched the first half of the first season, kind of fell away from it, and just never came back.
Yeah.
And apparently the universe is rewarding me by not making me suffer like the other Walking Dead fans, because they've invested in characters that keep having horrible, horrible things happen to them.
As opposed to Game of Thrones?
The other example of the same thing. and another show that I have fallen away from.
Really?
Yeah, I have not watched the last season and a half of Game of Thrones.
I haven't watched it because it's not out on DVD yet.
These are shows that seem to be actively cruel to their viewers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I've said, you know, I don't need that kind of emotional turmoil. The things I've been hearing, I mean, people I know that do watch these shows, I hear a lot of people saying there is actually a fan outcry to let this be the last season of Walking Dead. On the other hand, I had another hand.
You have four fingers and a thumb?
I did. And then I had a thought. It was even formed. And then something about Walking Dead just shoved it right on out.
The zombie ate your brain.
It did. It was kind of sad.
While you're thinking of that, I'll just throw in that I had heard lots of good things about it. I saw the first season or two. I pick up season one. And wife actually reached over, took the remote out of my hand and turned off halfway through the pilot, because it was just too creepy.
Yeah,
and so you know, I'm fine with it. I'm not missing out on it, but then again, I'm not a huge television consumer anyway. So.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I think I was going to make a point. I have no idea what it is now. The shows I enjoy, and the ones I enjoy the best, do have a level of fun within them.
Oh, yes.
Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., I think part of the reason they're back on track is they've let Coulson be snarky again. I mean, really.
He ever stopped?
Yeah, a little bit.
Really?
A little bit last season, I thought he got a little more uptight. We weren't quite getting as much of the snarky side of his personality. This season, it's back in full force. The Flash always has a fun edge to it. And Supergirl, the thing I love about Supergirl in the end is they play Supergirl herself as an adorable dork.
Yep, she's totally adorkable.
And, you know, yes, she's Supergirl, and she's capable, and she's powerful. But she also has this bubbly personality that just, she enjoys things. She's the embodiment of it's okay to like things.
One of the few clips that I've seen from it is when she's like, yep, that's my spaceship. It's just like... rock out.
And that was the crossover with The Flash the first time. So because he was like, oh, cool.
Yeah.
And that's, I think we need to have more emphasis on, you know, it's, let's send that message that we can, even, you know, we were talking about Ghostbusters earlier, and one of the observations Jennifer had is the humor in Ghostbusters is not inherently mean.
Yeah.
You know, it's not to say there aren't mean characters, but the spirit of the movie is not one that is inherently mean-spirited.
Yeah.
So, more of that. I think we need more of that right now. So.
Yes, we do need much more of that. Kind of, which kind of segues into another one of the costumes that I saw this year.
Mm-hmm.
A woman dressed in a very nice formal evening wear with a sash across the front that said, I'm so very sorry. She was a formal apology. And when asked about it, she's like, it's 2016. I think we're all due one.
I think what's interesting is I saw a gentleman in a tuxedo that was also a formal apology.
Yes.
So apparently one of the costumes du jour is the formal apology.
And we, after this last year, the number of people that we've lost, the number of gut-wrenching stomach punches we've had to go through this year, Yeah,
it's been rough.
Which brings us to the fact that, you know, I'm not going to go there.
Yeah. So, we're at a good point to discuss books.
Yeah. What are you reading?
Well, I just finished Imprudence.
Okay.
Which is the latest book by Gail Carriger as part of her steampunk series that started with the Parasol Protectorate.
I was going to say, this is the next generation, isn't it?
Yeah. So what she's done is, that used to be just the Parasol Protectorate books. I don't know what the world is called now because it has different series. They had the Parasol Protectorate, then it had a side series called the Finishing School series, which was like etiquette and espionage,
Pride, like, Prejudice and Zombies.
Yeah. It's Manners and Mutiny, I think, was one of, and it's stuff like that. The new series is called the Custard Protocol, and it is a series following the children of the protagonists of the Parasol Protectorate.
Okay.
So it is a next generation story. But one of the things I really like about it, and I liked it about Prudence, the first book in the series, was that while these are the children of the characters we followed in the first series, they are not next generational clones of their parents.
Ah.
They have their own personality. You see where their personalities are informed by their parents, but you also see where they've developed their own personalities. And so the children of a character who was very flighty in the first series, one of them is a very studious academic, and the other is a social maven, but is far more aware. That's not fair. The mother was aware. She was, in fact, her great thing is, I'm silly, not stupid. But she, unlike her mother, she's not silly. So, and it's just that kind of thing of, these are their own characters who just happen to be related to the characters from the first series.
Cool.
And it's a fun steampunk / supernatural series. I do highly recommend it. And apparently they have another side series coming out. It's set in Victorian culture, but they play a lot with social mores and social expectations. And there is a character who is a cross-dressing lesbian from the first series. And apparently there is a somewhat more erotic novel set in between both series featuring that character coming out.
Sometimes the slash just writes itself.
Pretty much. So, but it was, Gail is a great author because Gail does a lot of research. Her books are witty, but they are culturally appropriate witty because she understands the mores and standards of Victorian culture and uses that as a launching point for her stories.
Interesting.
So, well worth reading. I'm kind of torn on what the next book. I am still reading Ghostlight, the Marion Zimmer Bradley book, but I realize that's a book I'm saving for travel because it's a hardbound copy I have from my sister, and it's a perfect airplane book. Awesome. And I know I'm going to be traveling again soon for work, and I think I'm saving it for that. So I'm just deciding right now if my next book is going to be The Martian.
Mm-hmm.
I love the movie. I do want to read the book. Or if I'm going to go ahead and finally read Sandman Slim, or if I'm going to read the latest Wildcards novel. Those are my three up for grabs. I'm probably going to start the new one fairly soon, whatever one it's going to be.
Well, funny you mention Sandman Slim, because the guy who wrote that series, Richard Kadri, something like that, wrote a whole mess of Sandman Slim books, like six or seven at least. But come to find out, I just learned that he has a new series out. So, still urban fantasy sort. But this, I picked up the first one. It's called The Everything Box. Just got it from the library. And it's, okay, imagine Good Omens.
Okay.
If it was a triumvirate writing between Pratchett, Gaiman, and Christopher Moore.
Wow. That's an interesting add to the mix there.
Yes. I'm really enjoying this. It's good.
Well, because Christopher Moore, I mean, I see where the differences are, but he definitely would fall in line. He does the kind of the witty.
It's a
different kind of witty.
Well, it's a frank, for lack of a better term, it's a more American style of humor.
Yeah.
The I mean, both Gaiman and Pratchett, they've got that dry British humor down pat. But this is, I mean, some of it is down. I won't say it's slapstick, but it's close. But there's
Moore's done slapstick before in his books.
There's more banter in this. But so it's urban fantasy, because like I say, I really enjoyed the first couple Sandman Slim books. I think I made it through the first four or five.
Okay.
So similar concept, but different universe.
Okay.
And I think it's everything box. Everything remarkably box. Good.
All right. I think I'll probably start with Sandman Slim before I move on to any of his other work. But
it's wonderful. Yeah. I can't say enough good things about Sandman Slim.
So with that, I think we're at about our normal time.
Now it's time to... Oh, sorry, what?
No, because that makes me want to do the less clean version. And we are PG-13, damn it.
Damn it.
Damn it.
There's Janet, a... what?
Yeah, I haven't watched that yet.
I've
got recorded.
I'm flat refusing.
We might sometime talk about it, I don't know. Anyway, with that...
That would require us to watch
it first. It would. So with those shenanigans out of the way... if you'd like to drop us a line, we can be found at www.fanboynewsnetwork.com. Just leave us a note in the comment section. And with that, unless we get really tired again in the future, we should be back in about 2 weeks.
Yay!
So, we'll talk to y'all later.
Have a good fortnight, y'all.
This program is produced by Jeff Harris and Fanboy News Network, and is copyright 2016 to Jeff Harris and Fanboy News Network. All rights are reserved, including rights to copy and redistribute this program. All music in this podcast comes from The Footage Firm and is used under a royalty-free license.